That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded March 2017, Episode 1. It's all about the penguins.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent, and let's face it, sometimes irrelevant look, at some of the highest grossing movies of the last 80 odd years. I am your host David Callier, and today I am delighted to say that I am joined by...
I'm Sammy Kelsch, hi.
I'm Jo Carter. Hi.
And last, but by no means least...
Daisy Swoffer, hello.
Hello, and today, it's Mary Poppins.
You're not saying it right.
How well come?
Mary Poppins!
God, yeah, you've got to have the horrible Cockney accent.
Absolutely.
Apparently he was taught the accent by an Irish, voice coach, and apparently his accent was better than the Irishman's.
He sounds like he has pebbles in his mouth.
Yeah.
No one sounds like any of them have ever been to London. I mean, there are other things in this as well that prove that no one's ever been to London in this film. But, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not great on that point. So, the plot of the movie, what plot there is. This, obviously, as everybody should know because this film is relatively famous, is a musical piece.
Boy, is it.
Plots in musical pieces are not exactly the deepest plots in the world, so this might not take too long. The film is set in Edwardian London. There is a character, a shifty character with a very strange accent called Bert. He's entertaining a crowd by making lots of noise in a vaguely musical way. He does his little piece and tries to get money out of people and says, "Oh, there's a shift in the wind." Which is strange, because I'm fairly sure London winds don't always come from one direction.
But maybe they did in 1910.
Who's to see?
This is true. Perhaps in the early 1900s, there was just one direction of wind. Oddly enough, in a vaguely Deadpool-ish way, and this is the only way this film links with Deadpool, he then breaks the fourth wall, speaking to the audience and taking them on a tour of Cherry Tree Lane.
And now we get the introduction of Winifred Banks, who is the mother of the children of
Boats
the film.
For women!
Yes, I mean, at the start of this film, she is very much a case of, we are suffragettes and we want to change and get votes for women. And yet she seems almost as if she's doing it for fun.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, oh, we had a jolly lark and Mrs. What's-Her-Name was taken off by the police and, oh, it was such fun.
Yeah, it's a bit of a feminine mystique sort of, you know, suffrage. Because, I mean, yeah. She goes from, you know, sort of like, votes for women, woo, women's rights, super important, yada, 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 to, oh, gosh, I'm so dippy. I'd rather let my husband make those decisions.
Oh, I'm so grateful you're going to hire the nanny, darling. I couldn't do it myself.
Oh, no, I couldn't possibly take on that level of responsibility as a feminist. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it changes so very, very quickly.
It's not very consistent.
Almost as if it's a plot device.
Yeah. Mm.
So, yes, we meet briefly with Winifred and then find that Katie Nana, and there's a lot of normative determinism in this film.
Is there ever?
So the nanny is called Nana, has left their service because the two children have run away again.
I honestly am slightly concerned that there wasn't really that much worry that the children had run away.
Well, I don't think there's supposed to be that much of anything towards the children from the adults.
He did phone the police, but then he started phoning the police and his wife was trying to say a bit more information about it. And he actually says to her, "Kindly do not cloud the matter with facts."
Yes, I noticed that
was... What is that supposed to mean?
Yeah, it's slightly odd.
Post-truth was back then, even.
Yes. So, the nanny's left, the whole house is in chaos, the children are missing, although no one seems overly bothered by it.
They seem more concerned that they're going to have to look after the children themselves than, oh my god, where are the children?
Yeah.
And they are returned by the local constable who... According to my learned wife, tells me that he went on. Is that the one who went on to become
Constable,
a chip person?
Whatever his name is in the film, was a veteran character actor Arthur Treacher, who was also known, I think, in like the 30s for playing Jeeves a couple of times. And in the United States was best known as the sort of sidekick slash announcer of the Merv Griffin Show.
Which I've never heard of, but
there you
know.
Go, but it's America thing. But following on from this, he became the spokesman for Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips, a chain of fish and chip shops. that was found in, like,
that's brilliant.
And I remember reading last night that apparently one of the sort of managers of this franchise claimed that their recipe for authentic British fish and chips was based on Arthur Treacher's own. As if this is something that any of us actually cook in our own homes ever.
Yeah, it has always been a fast food. It's never been something you cook at home, mainly because deep frying fish is not safe in the house. Don't try it, kids. It could get messy.
Mm. Health and safety.
I did think that the local constable was actually the most human character we've come across as of yet.
Yeah.
Because he seemed to actually care about the kids, and I don't know, perhaps was supposed to be there to represent the audience to an extent as being someone who is aware of the fact that I guess the parents aren't in a social situation where they're allowed to or want to give their children any love. I mean, this is the whole basis of the movie, is that the parents learn to love their kids and learn to interact with their kids, which I guess embraces the whole Disney ethos of what family life should be like. And, you know, everybody's happy together.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the children have been found, they've been returned, they apologise. They asked their father to help build them a new kite because the kite was broken. Apparently they were chasing the kite.
Mm. As you do.
Well, they don't appear to go to school, so maybe they're just not very bright and didn't realise that if they just stayed still holding the kite string, the kite wouldn't stop running away.
I mean, that's actually a fair point. They don't seem to have any kind of education or... I mean, it's not that they're not bright. They seem to be using very sort of, I would say, beyond their years words in some of their sort of request for a new nanny, which we'll get to in a second.
Oh, I was going to say, is this a sort of situation where you know, sort of the nanny is essentially the governess and also does all of their homeschooling? But I mean, at this point in the middle of London, there will be schools for children. It's not like they're sequestered in a, you know, country house in the middle of nowhere.
So this was just a nanny, so this is not necessarily an educational role. Even if you go by what is requested in George's advertisement for a new nanny, that basically gets what sounds like a reasonably good definition of what Mary Poppins in the original books was like. So very stern and sort of harsh and, you know, there to instill discipline in the children.
She sounds great.
And no fun.
But no schooling.
Which again, yes, as I said, is very much like it seems to be in the original books. However, the kids have got another idea. They decide to write their own little note.
Which must be sung.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which must be sung because, well, it's a musical, and as with all musicals...
By this point in the film already, I was going, wow, we really... Any actual thing that's happening in a scene has to be sung about.
Yeah.
There's just a song for absolutely everything.
It does seem to be, yes, you're right, it does seem to be that there are lots of things that inexplicably outbreaking into song seems to be a theme of this film. They decide they want a new nanny, they decide they want someone who's nice and happy and never tells them off and, you know, basically the ideal of what a kid would want out of someone that is there to... You know, be a friend as opposed to a parent figure.
Loads of free sweets and no discipline.
Yay! Yeah, like that. Obviously, the father listens to this with, well, there's a couple of points in the film where I'm completely on the side of the father. That might just be because I'm a grumpy old man, but at times I was thinking, no, you're right, shut up, go away.
He actually has a surprising amount of patience as he listens to their sung letter rather than just going, oh, that's nice, take it out their hand and immediately tear it up without even hearing.
Well, I think Winifred had something to do with that because she could tell he was about to speak and sort of put her hand on his hand to like go, shut up and listen, dear.
Mm. He sees the letter that they write and goes, no, and tears it up and throws it into an empty fire. But the torn pieces start to move and magically they lift up through the chimney and into the sky to Mary Poppins.
Well, we've already seen her sitting in a cloud by this point, so we shouldn't be surprised by magic.
Actually, this is true. We did miss out the very start of the film when we had the titles. We then had a brief shot of Mary Poppins sitting on a cloud, which I guess to an extent sets the tone of the film. So yes, the letter from the kids magically flies into the air and I assume that Mary Poppins gets it, even though she seems to be manipulating things from the start anyway, because she is an evil time lady. We'll get to that in a minute as well. So the morning comes. There is a long line of very Harrodon-like looking nannies, all who I am sure are very good at their job. But no, a big wind blows, again, somewhat unrealistically, one feels they get blown away, but none of the trees or anything else do.
They're literally blown into the air and away, and the kids are watching and just laughing.
Yes, because there's nothing more fun than an old lady basically landing 3.5 miles away with a big splat.
These women are probably going to die. They're quite old. They're going to land terribly. And the children are just laughing. They're not calling for help. They're not concerned.
I'm calling it. They're kind of sociopaths.
Yeah, but they're children, which is what children are.
Sure, sweetheart.
And then Mary Poppins herself makes a grand appearance by floating down from the sky, which the children see as well, and they don't seem overly bothered by. Ooh. Through the entire film, the kids, the adults, everybody is very, very ready to accept the fact that strange and impossible things happen. And again, that may well be because this is obviously a Disney film and you've got to go with it, but there is certain elements where you think, why haven't they called the police or run away screaming or, I don't know, gone mad?
Because Mary Poppins is manipulating their minds?
That would be it.
Because it's magic.
So she appears, looking very much to modern eyes like Missy from Doctor Who, possibly the other way around. Sammy, you said you had a theory, or there was a theory, that Missy was indeed Mary Poppins.
Or certainly at least that Mary Poppins is a Time Lord.
Mm.
I mean, she's that got a TARDIS carpet bag.
But that could just be a Wizarding World extendable charm on the bag. Could just be a graduate of Hogwarts.
Possibly also true.
So are we saying that Harry Potter is a Time Lord?
Hogwarts graduate?
Yep.
Yes, so Mary Poppins arrives and she's shown in to see George, who, full of bluster, is confused by the fact that the letter that she's reading is the one that he ripped up and threw away.
Which is the only actual realistic response to magic happening in the whole thing, really. Because he's like, what? But no, hang on, that's not possible, what?
He's blathering and blithering, and Mary Poppins, to an extent, just employs herself.
Yeah.
She just imposes herself on the family.
I love the way that she encourages him thinking that he's gone mad as well by, like, not fessing up to how she got the letter. She's just like, what? You placed an ad, didn't you? And so, advert, here I am.
So yes, we now have a new nanny in the form of Mary Poppins, and that can mean just one thing. Incessant singing.
Yay!
Well, it is Julie Andrews, and she is awesome.
This is very true.
She has a beautiful voice.
So she introduces herself to the children, who are shocked. Probably by the first thing they've seen that they actually look slightly shocked by, which is her sliding up the banister.
Which is so much funner than, like, any Stannis stairlift I've ever seen, and I'm hella jealous.
Yeah.
They weren't fazed by the wind that blew the old people away. They weren't fazed by the wind that blew Mary Poppins in. But, oh no, someone defying gravity by flying up a staircase, then, you know, they were fully and officially agog by that.
Agog, that's a really good word.
So, she introduced herself to the children, and they have to tidy the nursery. Oh, the childhood horrors. But no, it's fine, because she's going to use magic to do it. And so actually, I don't...
She's making it a game.
She's making it a game, but she's not making it a game, because what she's actually doing is just magically doing the work for them. They don't do any tidying themselves. They just click their fingers and suddenly everything's tidy.
Yeah.
I think I watched this scene differently to you, because I saw the magic as a metaphor.
Well, that's a reasonable question, actually. Is a lot of what happens in the film supposed to be literally what happened, or is it supposed to be in the imaginations of the children and therefore seems to be real but actually isn't?
So what did you see in the scene, Daisy?
Well, for me, it was, okay, we're going to tidy the nursery, but it's going to be a game. And then she made it fun by them singing a song whilst they did it. And then for the kids experiencing it, it was like they were doing it by magic because they were having fun doing it.
Yeah, so it wasn't actually a magical event.
Yeah.
It wasn't the clothes and the toys and everything magically putting themselves away. It would just seem that way to the children. So
yeah,
this
that's
is,
how I've always
you know,
watched
what,
that
we're
scene.
Experiencing this through the eyes and the emotions of the kids, and everything seems magical. So yes, the room is tidy. Hurrah! It goes a little bit crazy at the end. Again, I'm not quite sure why. So in the process of the tidying up, Michael gets trapped in the wardrobe with some other bits and bobs that were being tidied away. And every time he tries to leave, the wardrobe door closes on him. I don't see how that's magical, really. That's just terrifying.
That was terrifying.
Possibly quite amusing for Jane, who is the sister, but for Michael, not good.
Yeah,
When the kid is trapped in the wardrobe, yeah, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that in 10 years' time, he's going to be fixing the inside of a wardrobe, he's going to have a panic attack, and he's going to be found basically sitting on the floor, crying to himself. Wow, suddenly Mary Poppins has gone very dark.
It wasn't already?
Well, okay, it was quite dark in some places. So yes, they do the song, which is A Spoonful of Sugar, which is one of the songs that I recognised as a Mary Poppins song. I believe, and possibly I should admit this, that I believe I've watched this film before, but I think I've only seen the first half. It's because after a certain point, none of it rang any bells. But actually, after the point where it was no longer in the animated scene, so I wonder if that's just because after that point, I either lost interest or it became a bit dull.
Yeah, it's very odd for me because I have a similar experience of remembering basically the first half of the movie and then nothing and then the very end. And I don't know why.
Sounds like you fell asleep.
This is certainly possible.
Thanks, Joe.
My recollection of this is that I watched this in mid-90s. So if nothing else, that was over 20 years ago, which is probably why I don't remember some of the scenes. They finish, they're tidying up, they put their coats on and they go out. Heading for a walk to the park. What could be more fun than a walk in the park? Outside, they meet Bert again. Now, Bert is a weird man that seems to have at least 5 jobs, depending on what the plot requires.
He's a jack of all trades.
He's a jack of all trades, but I think his main job description is plot device.
Yes. Well, apparently he was an amalgamation of several characters from the books, so that makes more sense in that context.
It does, although none of his jobs, with the exception of the one you come to later, which is chimney sweep, would actually really be classed as jobs. He is met at this point, he is working, I can't even say working, he is drawing.
He's busking, really, isn't he?
Well, he's busking originally, but the second time around, he's just drawing things on the pavement, on the street outside of the park.
He's busking with it, though, because he's putting his cap down asking for contributions.
Oh, yes, he's actually doing it for money, but it's not exactly a job.
Well, I mean, I think it's just because you've got in that day and age and even now, you know, if you don't have a solid income, then you've got to make money however you can. And having lots of jobs, I don't think that was uncommon.
No, agreed. But it was also he is apparently a chimney sweep. Now, in Edwardian London, I'm fairly sure chimney sweeps were very much in demand. So he could probably have done that full time and got an awful lot more money, which is the bit I didn't quite understand. Although, again, I say I think his main job is plot device. But he comes along, they come across him, he is drawing pretty pictures on the floor with a little bit of magic. Mary Poppins manages to transport all of them, including Bert, into one of the drawings, and it's a nice countryside scene of rural idyll and very much a stereotypical American view of what the English countryside is like. Having lived in the English countryside for a while, it's not like that. They send the children off ahead to play on a merry-go-round, yet, oddly enough, they seem completely unconcerned about this and then spend the next 5 minutes doing their own musical scene.
Is it just me, or do they walk in the opposite direction to where they sent the kids off?
Yeah, no, they absolutely did. Yeah. They said, kids, run along off that way, and then they went off by themselves, left the kids in this fake, and I assume possibly it was safe because it wasn't real, it was all in their imagination, but it struck me as a bit odd that they kind of just left the kids to it for a while.
It's a bit of a dick move to do that on a nanny's like first day.
I mean, this is also a fair point that this is literally her first day on the job
and she's already abandoned them.
Yeah,
unsupervised in an unfamiliar location
in a magical painting.
But if this is If that magic painting jumping into is a metaphor, as I think the Spoonful of Sugar song was, then they're still just stood on that little bit of pavement in front of the park. So she's actually keeping quite a close eye on them.
But Daisy, in that case, does that entire quite long sequence with like a horse race and all that jazz all take place with them just awkwardly standing around each other in one square of pavement?
Yes.
Holy
possibly
crap.
Going into the park at that point, but yes, this extensively far, overly long, ridiculous animated sequence of the film all took place at that little piece of pavement in front of the park.
See, because now I'm just imagining this quartet of people just stood there with sort of like
bouncing
docile
up down with their
smiles on their faces,
sort
of jumping up and down and sort of singing out of tune along with each other. And, yeah. And you know, passers-by walking by and being like...
They were going in a circle around the paintings, and then they went, look, our horses can break free, and then started going in more of a bigger circle, because they were still in
Wait, I buy into this entirely, because this is why I thought the Spoonful of Sugar section was potentially a metaphor as well. Because this entire thing, obviously, this is the stage that most people probably remember the most about the film, because it's the bit that goes full on Disney. Basically, the little fluffy animals and the talking cows and everything goes very, very much a Disney film.
Yeah, I hate this whole section of the film, except for Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
See, I don't necessarily hate it, but I can see why some people do, because it does seem to be almost crowbarred in from a different movie.
Yeah.
It does feel a little bit sort of discordant, because it's the only bit where we have this animation.
It does nothing for the plot.
No. Well, as I said earlier, there really isn't much of a plot. This is such a long part of the actual movie that I think this is part of the reason. The problem with it is that actually it doesn't ever go anywhere, because you've got these very pretty, you know, tuneful set pieces that do nothing to advance the plot and just literally are there for their own sake. And also because it's a Disney film.
I think it's this part of the movie that honestly made me think that there isn't a plot to the movie, because this is the bit that I remembered, and there is zero plot in this entire quite long sequence.
Yeah, all we're doing is we're watching some kids and their adult supervisor playing make-believe in a park for ages and ages.
Yeah, it's unnecessarily long.
You see, the thing that flummoxes me is it's meant to be English countryside, yet there are penguins.
Mm-hmm. Oh, don't even get me started on the English countryside.
Joe, it's magic.
I didn't mention it earlier, but during the whole Spoonful of Sugar sequence, and I hadn't realised this until obviously marrying Canadians, the robins in there are not robins.
Yes, they are.
When she leans out of the windows, and they are Canadian/American robins. Not
they are
British
indeed
robins.
The North American species of robin, which
is that why they're a funny shape?
That's why they're a funny shape, because that's what the species of robin looks like in North America. It's not.
I thought they were just bad animatronics.
No, it's actually quite accurate. They are a slightly larger bird. They have a different, you know, sort of bone structure. I was quite surprised when I moved
elongated.
Here and saw robins that, you know, are sort of these quite sort of squat, fat little birds, whereas I'm used to them being quite a bit sort of bigger. From an effects and animation standpoint, I think it holds up quite well. I think most of it looks really, really good.
Yeah.
It just, the sequence doesn't...
But from a plot perspective, it doesn't help.
As a writer, I just go, why? You could have cut, like, so much out of this scene, and it would have not ruined the movie.
Like the entire penguin bit.
My internal editor is just has got her scissors out, and it's just... poised.
But isn't that the whole point? It is a Disney film, and that's the sort of film Disney were making at that time.
Yeah.
They were making entire animated sort of long form films that were just dancing penguins.
I think if you'd have asked me when I was a child what my favourite bit of the movie was, I might well have said this section, but watching it as an adult, I find it torturous.
Yeah,
this is
have
true.
To agree.
As persons over the age of 30, we have different interests and different things that we're looking for in a film than you do when you're like 4 and you're just like, oh, look, dancing penguins, you know.
Yeah, I mean, kids like Jar Jar Binks. Yeah. That's saying everything.
What kids? Really?
Sorry, apparently it's true. Anyway, fun fact for later episodes, Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, starring Jar Jar Binks, is on the list of films we will be watching. So at some point in the future, and I'm not sure what the schedule looks like or when that will be, we will indeed be saying, how would, far too many times.
No.
How would.
How would. See, we've said it 3 times. That's too many times.
And we're not even covering that movie this week, so moving on.
So they are having fun, jolly times with animated characters, and oh no, everything goes dark. It's all going horribly wrong. Oh no, it's just raining.
Well, it is England. You had to get some rain in there somewhere.
Actually, I thought that was actually a reasonable sort of way of getting out of that scene, because it did seem to become... It, to me, seemed more suspenseful than it actually turned out to be. I thought something major was about to happen. But no, it's just raining, so therefore they're snapped back into reality.
They had to, at some point, justify the number of brawlies that that are important points in the film.
Well, it's Edwardian London. Everybody had a brolly.
I've got to say, the biggest thing about that whole animated sequence for me was how much I want to cosplay Mary's outfit in that.
I loved her skirt.
I was just wondering how high the waistband on his trousers is that he can pull them down that far and not, you know, show his underpants.
Yes.
It's like Sam and Cal.
Yeah, it all went a bit Hammer Time, didn't it, when the penguin... And going back to the, we keep going back to the penguin bit because I think, although by no means is it the favourite bit of the film, it's one of the bits where things actually happen. Even if those things are completely inconsequential, something happens. People remember that. The other bits seem to be... They just happen and no one seems to remember them. Personally, anyway. So that's the end of that little adventure. They...
This is when she gives them the magic potion.
Ah, yes. They have to take a spoonful of magic potion that tastes to them of something they like.
Lime cordial.
Yes.
Lime cordial.
Strawberry something.
I think she's probably just put some drops of actual nice things in with it, but she makes it like it's magic to the kids. Again, a metaphor.
Yes, so the next big adventure is they get given a list of things they need to buy. So Mary Poppins walks out of the house telling the kids what they need to buy and then meets a dog. Yes, really, a dog.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. A small, yappy, coat-wearing dog that spends, again, probably far
He's
too
cute.
Long. He's cute. It's a nice dog. Don't get me wrong.
Andrew is one of the best characters in the movie.
Oh,
Andrew is one of the best formed characters.
Looks like a character from Labyrinth.
So Andrew gives the message. Andrew's the dog, in case you hadn't picked up on that. That there's a problem somewhere and Mary Poppins must go and help immediately. So completely ignoring the fact that she's actually on the clock and doing a job, supposedly going shopping for the household, she just streams off, drags the kids behind her and goes to see Uncle Albert.
Yes, takes the children to a strange man's house.
Yes, and looks to be a slightly seedier part of London as well.
Yeah.
It's never clear to me, and indeed probably never at all, who Uncle Albert actually is. Is that just sort of an honorific? Is he actually someone's uncle?
I think it's an honorific.
But anyway, they've gone to see Uncle Albert, whoever he is.
He is veteran comedic American actor Ed Wynn. Which is why he doesn't sound like anyone else in the movie.
Yes, he does. He sounds an awful lot like Snagglepuss, but I think that's just a side thing.
No, he was the voice of the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, he was. Yes.
Yep. And he's from Pittsburgh, so possibly that's where Uncle Albert emigrated from originally, and has just sort of been adopted by certain locals as a colorful character.
So he has this affliction apparently, which, as it turns out, isn't unique, that when he laughs, he floats to the ceiling. Now, is this saying that laughing is good or bad?
I'm honestly not sure.
What happens if he laughs outside?
Laughing takes you out of yourself.
It seems to be contagious as well, which is odd.
Magic.
Yeah, well, again, all of it is no magic, or at least the eyes of the children is magic.
For me, this is the scene that I find the most forgettable of the whole movie.
Yeah.
I'd certainly forgotten it, so there you go.
Yeah, no, again, it's another session where nothing happens other than an excuse for a song and some special effects.
Mm. No, the entire Uncle Albert interlude doesn't actually do anything to progress the plot. It's just kind of an episodic extra thing that
Although
happens.
That said, it does progress the plot to an extent.
It does influence the ending.
Yes, because it actually influences what happens at the end of the film, which we'll get to shortly. But yes, no, that apart from that, it just introduces the fact that if you laugh hard enough, you float off. Which I'm sure lots of kids in the 60s tried terribly to do, failed miserably, and then found drugs and then did it that way. It was the 60s. Apparently these things happened.
Maybe that is what Uncle Albert... Maybe he's struggling with a drug addiction and that's why it's like, oh no, I thought we'd got him sorted on this and now here he is back again on the drugs.
Yeah, but... Did he give them to the children? Because the children were floating too. And that's worrying.
Yeah. Yes,
so was the table, so...
And the table. To inanimate objects, though, as well, because the afternoon...
But that's in their mind.
Yeah, but if they were hallucinating, then...
But that's, that was Mary's telekinesis, though. Okay, granted.
So this is where Mary introduces them to a drug addict and some drugs. This is a dark movie.
Right?
Well done, Disney.
Yeah, well done, Disney. So yes, they tell jokes and they float around the ceiling, although none of them actually touch the ceiling, I guess due to special effects limitations. And eventually they make themselves sad, so they have to float home. Oddly enough, not because of the jokes that were told, which were quite terrible and made me sad. Even the ones that turned up later. So, moving on. George is apparently becoming increasingly annoyed by the happiness in his household. Yeah, again, this scene is slightly worrying in the fact that obviously Mary Poppins is manipulating him into sending the kids to work for, you know, the day. Oddly enough, on Tuesday, which is her day off. Mm-hmm. Almost as if she's trying to get rid of them for the day. So yes, it's bring your kids to work day, which, as we all know, will go horribly wrong.
Terrible idea.
But then, but before he takes them to work, she implants ideas in their head about the lady that sits on the steps of St. Paul and wants tuppence to feed the birds.
Ah, yes, we have the tuppence a bag song.
Yes. The most important thing in the movie.
I mean, actually, I do remember this song as well, but whether that's because I'd heard it elsewhere or whether I heard it in the film or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I remember the Simpsons parody of it.
That's probably where I know it from as well.
I think it might be.
But not necessarily the most memorable part of the film.
For me, this has always been the most memorable song.
So yes, so they take the boy and the girl to the bank day, where old man Mr. Dawes Sr., played rather unconvincingly by Dick Van Dyke, but at least his accent's slightly better this time.
See, as an adult, it's so blindingly obvious to me that mm-hmm. was Dick Van Dyke, but as a child, I never clocked it.
You say that, but it took me... I will confess, it took me a good 10 minutes of him being on screen for me to realise that's who it was. I know it was a ridiculously bad old age wig, and it was definitely a skull cap, and the makeup wasn't great, but it was a while before I worked out that it was actually Dick Van Dyke.
It's as soon as he does any physical comedy for me that made me go, oh yeah, Dick Van Dyke, yeah. Of course.
I have to admit, I'd forgotten, because I did know that, but then when the credits came up, I went, oh, that's why he looked so familiar.
Yeah.
And then I felt like a fool.
I might have looked on IMDb before the end of the film as well, just to make sure. So yes, so Dawes, the bank manager, who is...
He's well past retirement age as well.
But again, he's one of the board bank members, or bank board members, and I don't know how...
Well, the board bank board members.
Well, it was definitely boring. I don't know whether this is vaguely realistic and whether they had, you know, family banks like that. I mean, this is before the days of NatWest or TSB or any other banks are also available. So it might be that these were old venerable banks owned by individuals or by consortiums, and actually it would be that you would be there until you die. Anyway, so we have a situation where Dawes Sr. tries to take the tuppence. Remember that from that scene about 10 minutes ago?
But not until after they've sung a song to teach the kids about compound interest, and that's where I first learned about compound interest.
Oh, God, that was so yes. boring.
That's one of my favourite songs, Fidelity Fiduciary Bank. I love that song.
So yes, he tries to get the money from him, but no. Young Laird wants to spend his money on the Bird Lady. And that's actually her official title in the title cards is Bird Lady. Which is disappointing because she's neither a bird. Well, actually, she might be a lady. I really can't comment. No, give me my money back. Scream, shout. Overheard by the patrons of the bank, assuming that actually someone's being denied their money and there is a run on the bank.
And that's where I first learnt about runs on banks.
Which is in itself slightly weird because it's blatantly obvious that the person screaming and crying is a child. So therefore, yep. probably doesn't have a lot of money invested in the bank anyway.
Yep.
There's a panic. Everybody demands their money. And then randomly, people from outside start demanding their money as well. I didn't understand how suddenly people from across the street and across the town suddenly realised there was a run on the bank.
Because rumours spread.
Does everyone bank with the same bank?
Was there an internet connection or something? I don't know. It seems somewhat...
Pigeons.
I was about to say it seems somewhat unrealistic, but then I realised we're talking about Mary Poppins, so I retract that statement.
We're seeing this from the eyes of the children, essentially, as well. So maybe what we saw of people coming from miles around as a run on the bank was actually just the people who were already in the bank, and it just felt like everyone from all over London.
Well, they just saw adults rushing in. They were tiny and they wanted to get out. I mean, I was in that situation when I was I was a bridesmaid at my godmother's wedding. I was, I don't know, three. And all these tall adults, and I couldn't see my mummy. And I got very lost. And I have this weird memory of that, of a sea of adult legs and me being tiny. So, I mean, they weren't as small as I was then, but, you know, from a child mentality, they just wanted to get out, and they did. Yeah. They ran away.
So they ran away again. It seems to be a theme of them running away from their terrible parents.
Oh, they're running away from their problems.
Yeah. So they run away, and they run back towards their house. You can tell it's back towards their house because it's the same paintings of London that used earlier and later. However, at this point, there seems to be populated by lots of really evil people. A crone tries to grab up them, and dogs bark, and then they're attacked by a large... Well, I don't know. I mean, it's blatantly Bert, covered in, you know, soot. But I felt that was a little bit racist at that point.
Yes.
It's a
I'm
large
glad I'm not
black
the only
man.
One that thought
yes,
that.
Yes, that's... Yes.
Oh, good, good. Glad I'm not the only one that got really, yeah, bad blackface overtones from that.
That's the problem with some older movies, is they have some really uncomfortable things in them like that, yes.
So, yes, they're grabbed by this dark-skinned hooligan who turns out to be Dick Van Dyke with a terrible accent. They first have a long heart-to-heart with Bert about how their father is really just sad and
he's got a hard
tied
life
to his desk, and it's such a hard life, which is weird because not really shown any of those symptoms so far. He's just really shown himself to have a stick up his arse, and you know. Anyway, so yes, apparently Bert's now a chimney sweep. I know we mentioned this earlier, but this is now the case. Again,
apparently
plot
so.
Devices are ours.
Well, it was a thing in 1910 London. How better to incorporate chimney sweepery than to have, like, your one Cockney dude character also do that?
Yeah, true.
Saves on having to cast another actor, doesn't it?
Hmm.
So Bert takes the kids back to their house. The mother's about to go off and have another rally with the suffragettes, and so
votes
she's
for women. I first learnt about suffragettes through this movie.
This movie is very educational for you, isn't it?
It was, and it stayed with me.
The bit that struck me about this scene more than anything is that the mother was so desperate to get rid of the responsibility of looking after her own children that she was willing to foist it off on
a guy she just
met. Now, I don't
know
whether they knew Bert previously. I mean, he obviously had been seen around because, well, he seems to be on every street corner. But
random
not someone
guy.
They know to trust with a child.
Would you trust
and certainly
odd
not
job
one
guy
that
with your kid?
Yeah.
Like, one of his odd jobs is nanny.
Also possible.
Well, yes. And so he's like, well, okay, I tell you what, you can clean our chimneys and look after the kids at the same time, because I
see no problems with this.
I mean, I'll confess this here and now, and this might be a shock to anybody who knows me, but I've never actually been up a chimney. But if I have been up a chimney, I'm guessing at that point I don't have a lot of visibility of the two kids I'm supposed to be looking after.
Yeah.
Which so is they could just run off again, or, you know.
Probably how they also ended up the chimney.
Yes. So there's this the whole thing about Bert's cleaning the chimney of the family house, and he's explaining to the kids about updrafts and how wind catches the top of the chimneys and pulls the smoke up, which is, again, educational and completely, you know.
At least it's scientifically accurate.
It is, actually. It
which
is
makes
actually
a change.
How chimneys work, so.
Yeah, for a film that, you know, defies a lot of natural laws, it does adhere to this one, at least.
Speaking of defying natural laws, yes, they all fly up the chimney.
Oh, yeah, I suppose it kind of gets a bit, yeah, less natural at that point.
Young Michael is looking up the chimney and suddenly he gets swept up by a large updraft and gets pushed up to the roof of the house in London, which is flat.
That's where Mary Poppins comes in.
Yes, at that point Mary Poppins comes in. But that's something that struck me is that all the roofs seem to be... There was a lot of flat roofs in London, which I don't know.
They also were doing quite nice parkour at that point.
Yes, this is where it gets a bit Assassin's Creed-y, definitely.
But the thing was that were loads of flat roofs that they were dancing on, but if you look at the street, there's not that many houses together, so it was like they were transported to a different set of rooftops.
Yes, no, the actual Cherry Tree Drive does seem to be a fairly spaced out, fairly fairly upper class, I suppose it was upper class housing.
I shudder to think the rent.
It's like South Kensington or something.
Yeah.
God.
But there's several things about this scene struck me as wrong.
Who can live there? Who can afford to live there?
I mean, not only the fact that the roofs were flat in London, where it rains heavily. We've seen this.
Yep.
But also the fact that...
Well, I was really freaked out by the chimney that was shaped like a T that was too tiny for anyone to get in that then had two heads sticking out of it. That always freaked me out as a kid because I'm like, that's just physically impossible.
Yes, because everything else in this film is completely possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But see, everything else is explained with magic, but the chimney sweeps aren't magic.
With this, then we're looking at it from the metaphor, from the children's eyes thing again, then I don't get this scene. Are the kids actually on the rooftop and just pretending, or is he telling them about chimney sweeping but not actually doing it?
I feel we are actually just analysing this film far too much, but I think at this point we are supposed to assume that they are up on the roof, and the whole dance scene with the highly choreographed chimney sweeps, because that's what chimney sweeps do on their day off, is they choreograph dance moves.
Except for Bert, who does all the other things as well. The others are all working on their dance moves while he's drawing chalk paintings.
That's because he doesn't need to practice.
And thus the Chippendales were born. So they have the whole thing on dance. And actually a major point in this film that we have completely necessarily not mentioned yet is the absolutely batty next door neighbour who has a cannon the roof.
Well, that's a very sort of stock British character, isn't it? The sort of, you know, slightly the venerable but slightly mad retired military gentleman.
Absolutely, but as a general rule, you're still not allowed to have firearms mounted to the roof of your
house. I love that the neighbours are all okay with this as well. They're just like, 8 o'clock posts, let's try and stop all our stuff from smashing. Oh, he's such fun, our neighbour.
Well, you know, I suppose he's reasonably harmless apart from, you know...
yelling at his neighbours on the street. But
they're probably
banks!
Also all very well insured.
Yes.
And so any damage that does incur against this, they'd be able to claim.
Cannon vibration insurance.
Not only the vibration of the cannon, where does the cannonball go? Does he actually fire cannonballs? He does fire fireworks at the chimney sweep. I suspect because the idea of firing cannonballs at dancing chimney sweeps was probably a bit much for Disney.
Well, he did say that they were the Hottentots, which I think is very racist.
But if he's mistaken them for black men, you know...
That's the sort of generation that guy comes from, is having come from, you know, sort of the wars over there and fighting the whatever
fuzzy wuzzies
from
and
the blizz blows and the flim flams over in blah blah land. I'm trying to use words that sound like the kind of racist words that they would use without actually saying anything that is genuinely racist.
Much appreciated.
It makes me very uncomfortable.
He fires fireworks at the dancing chimney sweeps, which. I don't know. I mean, that's got to be up there with sort of some sort of assault charge.
It's
not safe, certainly.
I guess it's just a plot device to get them all then to magically jump down into the household of Jane and Michael.
And they all shoot out getting dust everywhere, but magically it's all just on this one white sheet, which would never happen.
Yes, no, their magical powers are beyond comment for people that are basically just manual labor chimney sweeps.
Hey, people in this movie can tidy up by snapping their fingers.
Mm.
I don't know how far we can really question this at this point.
True. So all the chimney sweeps leave, shaking George by the hand, because apparently that's good luck.
Oh, after they've danced through the house with all the servants. They dance with Winifred, they dance with the cook, they dance with the housekeeper.
Thank you. Yes, that's what they do.
And then Mr. Banks.
And then dance with George.
Yeah.
And then they all basically get out of the house and Bert and George have a heart-to-heart where Bert, the single man who seems to take kids on dangerous adventures, tells George, the responsible father, that he should spend more time with his kids and, you know, enjoy their growing up.
Well, that's actually, you know, a fairly good point.
It is a fairly good point. It just...
There's a sage piece of advice, sure.
I don't know. I mean, this is the breadwinner of the household, let's not forget, you know.
Yeah, but I think if back then... You know, it had been more important for fathers to spend more time with their children, then we wouldn't be in quite such a mess now.
He does like to come home and by like at 6:01 and by about 6:04 he wants the children to be gone to bed. So, yeah.
Yeah.
He could spend more time with them at that point.
Yeah.
3 minutes is not enough.
But so George is summoned back to the bank at 9 o'clock in the evening. George walks back through London, back through the same streets we saw earlier with the crones and the dogs, But at 9 o'clock at night, it's fine because London's deserted by 9 o'clock, as we all know. Yeah, there was no one on the streets at all. So he takes the long. I mean, Sammy, as you said, actually, that was stylistically a very pretty piece of the film, where he's walking back through the park. It is very nicely shot.
It's one of my favourite shots of the film. It's beautifully composed.
But as a thing, it just, again, it doesn't seem to make sense. Why would he be summoned there at 9 o'clock? Why would they all be basically standing or sitting around a table like a coven of vampires at 9 o'clock at night?
Because bankers are freaking sinister.
Yeah, I guess that's what they're trying to put
across. Apologies to any bankers listening. I don't mean it. I love you all. Please. But bankers
in 1910 were sinister.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Bankers in 1910 were sinister. Now they're nice, and I love you all.
They're sitting around a table. There's a red accent somewhere. It's all very dark. It is, to me, it struck me as being very vampire coven-like.
Mm. It was really creepy. I do not like this part. I don't understand what they do.
Well, this is it. I mean, at this point, the Wikipedia says he is given a humiliating cashiering. Now, that's not something I know of, but...
A humiliating cashiering.
That is the phrase.
Yeah? What? They de-head his flower, and then they punch his hat, and then he ends up, when he's at home, his tie's all askew as well.
It just seemed like property destruction, which was kind of adding insult to injury when they're sacking him and ruining his stuff as well.
It's just sort of, it's not enough to just dismiss you. We have to publicly humiliate you.
But it's 9 o'clock at night. Who's going to see?
London's deserted.
London's deserted. What does it matter?
The people and at also, the banks or...
I'm not sure whether those were provided by the bank, but if not, they'd be getting a bill for destroying my hat and my umbrella. Yeah.
The umbrella as well. Yeah, it was just really, Absolutely. It really creeped me out, this bit.
The shock as well. Not the umbrella.
But I don't actually remember whether he was actually told he was fired or whether he received any kind of official notification that he'd been fired or whether just the act of destroying his property was supposedly, you know, enough.
Yeah, as soon as they went for the flower, then he knew, oh, that's it, then I've lost my job.
Yeah. I'm stuffed, yeah.
But then it's fine because he just basically blurts out supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Which fixes everything.
God, I actually said it first time.
Yay!
Tells one of Uncle Albert's terrible, terrible jokes that the children had told him and heads home because, you know, nothing to worry about. I've done my bit. I'm now broke and I have no job and my family's going to be destitute.
Yeah, it does feel a bit like he's had a mental break at this point. Like, things have gone so bad that he can't cope with it anymore and all he can do is go manically happy.
Yes, it does seem there's definitely a bit of a psychotic episode.
Yeah, like, doesn't seem like a good thing.
There is sort of that sense of sort of ecstasy that sometimes comes with really, really, really terrible things happening, like losing your job or whatever, really. Like, it's fine, I don't care, I don't need it, I'm free, I can do whatever I want, before the reality of the fact that you now have no income sets in.
But that never seems to actually set in.
It sets in probably just after the credits roll, and he's like, oh my god.
No, he gets his job back by then.
We're going to have to fire the domestic help, you know.
So yes, he tells one of the jokes to Dawes Sr., who mulls the joke over and with the wit and wisdom of a 170-year-old man or whatever he's supposed to be, finally gets the joke and miraculously he starts laughing and floats into the air.
It's probably the first time he's ever laughed in his life.
Well, potentially, but then why float?
Because it's a metaphor. You know,
the next day, oh look, the wind has changed. Because as we said, wind only ever comes from one direction for a long period of time. Mary Poppins is leaving.
And the children are very upset.
Which is understandable because it's probably the only adult in their life that's given them any time or any kind of fun. Originally, Mary Poppins was asked, would she ever leave? And she said she'd leave when the wind changes. And the wind does change again. That was definitely a metaphor.
A symbolic wind.
Yes, so Mary Poppins is leaving. However, a happier George is at home fixing the kite that was the main thrust of the problem.
But using Michael's money to do it.
Yes.
But yeah, it's, like, it's really? Gloss over that. I mean, he's not going to have any money. He's just been fired. So why not spend the little savings they've got on a bit of wood and paper? And lo and behold, the kite needs a tail. So, sod the whole suffragette bit. Why don't you just use my sash as a sort of a tail on the thing, says the mother. The assumption there in many ways might be that she's actually just forgoing suffragettes and going back into being part of the family home. But actually, in an earlier scene, we did see three or four of those sashes. Yeah. So it's not necessarily that she is just giving up
on her
causes.
Well, she's advertising across the London skies now. Yeah. It's on the kite.
Yeah.
Mm. But equally, she was never, as I said earlier, she was never particularly committed to the cause. So
she wasn't a good suffragette, but then on the other hand, she was also, you know, not a good parent. I think there was, you know, a certain implication in the fact that she's off to go do some women's, you know, sort of march for votes or whatever, so she couldn't look after her children. Oh no. Yeah. Which would have been kind of the fear of people who were against the women's suffrage movement, surely. That, oh no, if they get this little bit of freedom, then they're going to want other freedoms, and then they're going to abandon their kids and blah, 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 yada, 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 barf.
Mm. Yeah. Although they might have already abandoned the kids. Anyway, so they've got a kite. It's windy, that's right. You go flying it in the park and with everybody else that we've met. Everybody else we've met in the film so far is also in the park flying kites. Now, so they're in the park with I think, probably with the exception of maybe Andrew, everybody else we've seen in the entire film, apart from Mary, who obviously is packing and making her way out of the world. They meet the rest of the banking clan, who have just found out that their senior banking manager...
One of the guy's dads.
One of the guys... Yes, exactly. One of the guy's dads has died of laughter. He's died happily in his bank last night. And so what do you do when your father or one of your work colleagues dies? That's right. You go down the park and fly a kite.
And his death was directly attributable to Mr. Banks there as well.
Yeah, so they offer him his job.
Yep.
Instead of having him arrested.
Yeah.
True, but on the other hand, I guess that's how it works in those sort of situations, is you are in a place where the only way to get up in the world is by the death of the senior person above you. Then, you know, if the person above you dies, it's very Klingon in some ways. If the person above you dies, then you take their place.
Or very monarchy.
So yes, George is given his job back as a junior partner, which I don't remember what his previous role is, but I think that's probably where he was before. So
I think he was given a promotion.
Was it a promotion?
Yeah.
That's the way forward then. Kill your bosses.
Yep.
No, kids, don't kill your bosses. Or your teachers. Don't kill anybody. It's generally a bad thing.
He killed him with kindness, at least. Making him laugh.
But yes, so George has reconnected with his children. He's got his job back and everything's well with the world.
But now he's got a promotion. He'll be spending more time at the bank and even less time with the children.
Yeah, realistically, they're not going to see him at all.
Yeah.
Ever. Like, no. It's going to be, you know, and pretty soon they're probably going to get sent off to boarding school, you know.
Yeah, because they do need an education.
Realistically, in this era, at this level of sort of social, like, society, absolutely.
What I'd love to see is, you know, 20 years down the line, what happened to this family? You know, I'd like to see that.
Nice segue.
Excellent. Well, hang on, before we go into that, Mary Poppins flies away, Bert bidding her a fond farewell.
Goodbye, Mary Poppins.
Don't stay away too long. which is kind of weird, because it assumes that she comes and goes and that she is known to everybody here. Obviously, everybody knows who Mary Poppins is. But does she live in the... Does she just live on the south of the river? Is that all it is?
She lives in the clouds. We saw her at the start.
She was hanging out on the clouds, but I didn't see, you know, sort of a block of flats or anything.
Well, that was like her back garden cloud. Her house cloud was just outshot.
See, what I want to see is her house cloud, where she actually lives.
Yeah, well, maybe that'll be, you know, Mary Poppins' house film.
Does she not just open her bag, step in, and then in the control room just dematerialise and disappear off again?
Quite possibly.
With whooshing TARDIS noises, yeah.
Yeah, well, unless she takes the handbrake.
She apparates off somewhere, or uses the flu network, obviously.
God, too many fandoms collide. So yes, Mary Poppins is off. And that's the end of the film. Now the songs come back to haunt us.
And then we get the clever anagram reveal of Mr. Dawes Sr. being Dick Van Dyke.
I'd never have guessed.
You say it's a clever anagram reveal, but the actual anagram that is before it's sort of revealed isn't really even words. It's just random letters put together
But it sounds like a name, because I was thinking, who's that? And then I kick myself in the face because I remembered. But
don't kick yourself in the face. That's definitely not so. Yes, that is the end of Mary Poppins, but wait, Mary Poppins will return in gold no wait Mary Poppins will return in What's the...
Mary Poppins Returns?
It is actually called Mary Poppins Returns.
Mary Poppins will return in Mary Poppins Returns. Brilliant.
In 2018, potentially, on Christmas Day.
So if you've enjoyed watching Mary Poppins or you've rewatched Mary Poppins, then don't worry. There's more coming. So yes, that is Mary Poppins. We will wrap up here. Any final thoughts from anybody?
I still love this movie.
Okay. That's allowed. We're not here to slag movies off. I mean, there are movies on this list that I absolutely love.
Because you didn't seem to like it much, and I love it. So I feel bad that you don't love it.
I
like it. I do.
I enjoyed it. It's not a film I'm going to rush back and watch again, but I enjoyed it.
I liked it more before I read Dave's article thing.
It wasn't my article. I have to point out that I didn't actually write it. Is that the New Yorker article?
Yeah, the one about becoming Mary Poppins or whatever it traditional family values. You should put that in the show notes.
I will do. And also, if you just do a Google search for Mary Poppins, it's fairly high up on the list of search results.
However, I haven't read it, so my experience is not tainted.
So yes, Joe, any last thoughts?
I don't understand the animated penguins, but the songs have been stuck in my head all week, so I'm going to take that as a good sign.
Yes, I think that's possibly fair. No one understands the animated penguins other than the fact that it's a Disney film, and I think that's the only reason they're there.
They're not English.
Neither's Dick Van Dyke.
Some studio executive said, you know what, kids like penguins. Can we get some penguins in the movie somewhere? And the producers were like, I guess.
Mary Poppins taught me about a lot of things, it seems, and watching it again has reminded me that it was the first place I learned about quite a few different things, and I think that's a good thing.
It was. There are certain films that teach us certain things, but a lot of them aren't from Disney. Mm-hmm. Sammy, any last thoughts?
Anyways, final thoughts, I think I know objectively that his accent is so terrible, but I really have a soft spot for Bert.
Mm.
I just think he's lovely.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a fair point to leave it. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And we'll be back in an unspecified amount of time for our second film, which I believe is the original Rocky film. So tonally very similar to Mary Poppins in many ways.
An excellent transition.
Thank you for my fellow hosts. Thank you, Joe.
Hi.
Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you.
And thank you to my lovely wife, Sammy.
Word.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing network. Find us on Twitter at @podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcast Thing. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.